Welcome. Could everyone please take their seats and please try to sit close to the front so we can all hear each other better. Good morning. My name is Debbie Robinson. I am Director of Marketing of M. Robinson & Company, Mass Tax Lawyers on Federal Street in Boston. I want to thank you all for coming in this difficult weather. We appreciate your attendance and look forward to your questions. I would also like to publicly thank our events department, which includes Tamar Grinvogel, who I think you've all met at the registration desk, who was the editor of your study booklets, and Yechiel Robinson, paralegal, who is a production assistant and research assistant. I would also like to introduce the attorneys from our firm who are speaking today, and you can please rise. Morris Robinson, CPA tax attorney, my husband, Timothy Weeks, LLM, and Matthew Morris, LLM. And we have in attendance today William Krupp, management and program analyst of the IRS Taxpayer Advocate Service. He may not be in the room this minute.
He is
just coming in the door. This is William Krupp. And Michael Matuzak is the settlement officer of the IRS Appeals Office, and he's traveling from East Hartford, Connecticut. He works with Matthew McLaughlin, who's chair of the IRS Appeals, and I'm guessing he's still in traffic, but he will be speaking after our intermission. Araceli Rios, CPA, IRS Senior Stakeholder Liaison, is in the back of the room. Thank you very much for coming. And Norman LeBlanc, CPA of Kahn Litwin Renza, CPAs from Providence, Rhode Island, is also en route. He spoke at our last program. I am pleased to introduce to you now one of the speakers for our next event. His name is Bradford Taylor, MBA, from Kahn Litwin Renza CPAs in Waltham. He's the new director of business valuations, and he will be one of our speakers at our next event. If you would like to mark your Blackberries, the next event will be at Bentley University on Thursday morning, June 23rd. Same schedule, hopefully not delayed by snow, 7:30 to 8:30 buffet breakfast, bagels from Kupel's, and 8:30 to 12:30 program, qualifying for 4 hours of continuing professional education for CPAs just on time for the June 30th deadline. That was planned. The panel will be an all-star team, not only including Bradford Taylor, but including Doug Baumel, the president of the Family Firm Institute of New England and Continuity Family Business Consulting, which specializes in breaking log jams among family members and business succession planning, and Steve Burke, CPA LLM, who is the managing partner of McLean Law in the Woburn, Massachusetts office. They have three offices in New Hampshire, the largest law firm in New Hampshire. And if you go to his website bio, you will see an introductory presentation on business succession planning. Our program will be entitled When Business Succession Gets Stuck. We're going to take it beyond the elementary level and have case studies about how conflicts can be resolved so that families are not throwing out the baby with the bathwater. So we look forward to seeing you there. And I also want to make one more public service announcement on behalf of Millie Tobolsky, CPA. Could you show everybody who you are? Millie is the director of the South Shore Forum of CPA's monthly study group. And they are meeting tomorrow at the Chateau Restaurant at 551 John Maher Highway in Braintree. And they also have an all-star panel of speakers. If you can make it at 7:20 a.m., it's not too late to reserve. Please see Millie and her flyer if you'd like further information. I would like to point out to you that on the back of your study folders, there is an evaluation form. We would appreciate it if you would take a few minutes to fill out your evaluation of our seminar and give us any suggestion for future events. We do read them, and we appreciate it. The one thing we did decide, even without your feedback, is to return to Bentley. Although the June event, since this room is booked, will be at the auditorium on the other side of the campus, which seats 250 people. So when the announcements start coming out in March, please post them on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and invite all your friends. We can see 250. So now I would like to introduce Morris Robinson, who will begin our program. Attorney Jay Darby from Greenberg Traurig was booked to be our speaker this morning, but regretfully had to withdraw at the end due to an unforeseen conflict. However, he has sent his chief assistant, Attorney Jeffrey Groshak, who's a CPA as well as a tax attorney, and has spoken before and is well prepared to substitute for him. And Attorney Groshak will convey his own apologies. But I think we will all be pleased that we will have top-notch content regardless.
Thank you all, and thank you, Debbie, for putting this all together. A lot of work goes into putting something like this together. You'd be surprised if you haven't done it already. In your materials, if you take a look on the left-hand side, at the top, there is a syllabus, and we're going to be following the syllabus. So even though we also have some PowerPoints, if you use the syllabus, you'll have an opportunity to understand where we are and what we're doing. We have the various times put in place, and we were thinking to start about 8:30, and so we've blown that, but we do hope to have a fairly tight presentation. We're happy to take your questions, but try to be brief with your questions, and we will try to also be fairly brief with our answers. If you need to talk to us, we'll be happy to talk to you afterwards and make sure that you have your questions answered. Our first panel is working with the automated collection service and how to get an accurate assessment. For many of your clients, the automated collection service may be the first step, the first contact that you have with the Internal Revenue Service. And dealing with the automated collection service effectively is very, very important. Sometimes the amounts involved may be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And yet, the first contact is likely to be the automated collection service, especially if we're dealing with individuals. So with that, I'm going to ask Matthew Morris from our office to get started, and I will be participating as well.
Thank you, Morris. Good morning, everybody. Thank you all for getting here, making it through the rough weather. It wasn't easy, but appreciate you having everybody here. So I'm just going to be talking about dealing with the automated collection service. Before I do that, I want to talk a little bit about what it means, what an assessment means, because basically all of the collections activities are going to stem from an assessment. So we have to figure out how income tax is assessed first. The next thing we're going to address is how a taxpayer can be notified of the assessment, the various notices that a client might bring to your office, so you can sort of see where you are in terms of the assessment timeline. Is it pre-assessment or post-assessment? And then we're going to talk about what options are available to the taxpayer if he agrees with the assessment and what options are available if he or she does not agree. So let's first get to what an assessment is. And just to keep it very basic, an assessment is basically what legally entitles the IRS to collect on a tax. It is shown, once the tax is shown in the IRS books is owed by a particular taxpayer, that's when an assessment is going to issue. And for purposes of the statute of limitations, the date of assessment is very important. So statute of limitations is going to run from the date of assessment. We've mentioned statutes of limitation on assessment. These are the basic statutes of limitations. So the IRS has 3 years to assess a tax from the later of the due date of the return or the date the return is actually filed. In cases of substantial understatement, which is 25% of the gross income, it's going to be a 6-year statute of limitations. Keep in mind, you might know this already, but there's no statute of limitations for unfiled or fraudulent returns. And there can be an extension of the statute of limitations on assessment if the taxpayer fills out a form 872. So those are the basic statutes of limitation issues. Keep in mind, there are two main types of assessments. One type of assessment is a summary assessment, and this would arise after a taxpayer has filed a tax return. And so if the taxpayer files a return and doesn't request an abatement of that tax within 60 days, then an assessment will issue after that time. So that's a summary assessment. A deficiency assessment is determined after an examination, and this could be with or without the taxpayer's consent. The taxpayer might consent to the changes as recommended by the auditor, and sign off on those changes, or maybe not. Maybe he doesn't agree and just ignores the notices that he's getting. So there is a 90-day statutory notice period. You might have seen something called a 90-day letter. And if a taxpayer doesn't file a petition to the tax court before the expiration of that 90-day period after receiving the 90-day letter, then an assessment will issue after that expiration of the 90-day period. And so those are the two main types of assessments. All right, now we're going to talk a little bit about the notices, types of notices that a taxpayer might receive. One is an assessment letter, which basically just looks like a bill, essentially, from the IRS. It's from a service center, and it's listing a particular tax due for a particular tax year. There are also a series of CP letters, and the CP letters are requests for payment. There's a CP 501 letter. It's a reminder of tax due. The language gets sort of increasingly more threatening as the CP numbers get higher. The CP 503 says important, immediate action is required, which is request payment within 10 days. And then there's a CP 504 notice, and that's a little more aggressive. It says urgent, we intend to levy on certain assets. But the letter that is actually included in your materials is the letter 1058, and that is the notice of intent to levy and right to a hearing. And if you look in your materials, it actually should be on top on the right side, and you see all the, it's kind of the redacted form here with all the blacked out information. So this is a notice of intent to levy and your right to a hearing. This is what's known as a 30-day letter. And so remember, these notices are all, it's important to keep in mind, these notices are all post-assessment. The pre-assessment notice we talked about was the 90-day letter. It's a pre-assessment notice. The CP letters and the assessment letter, all those things are post-assessment. This is your sort of the final post-assessment notice before levy action starts to take place. And it's very important to know what your rights are at this stage. You've got 30 days to file an appeal after receiving this notice. And we're going to talk about appeals in Panel 3. I won't go into that in detail at this point, but I do want to mention that you've got 30 days to file an appeal after receiving this letter before any levy action. Okay, so this is the official CDP notice. It gives taxpayer 30 days notice of appeal rights. Another letter you might see is a notice of federal tax lien filing. Now, it's important to keep in mind that as soon as a 30-day letter is issued, I would actually say be prepared for a lien filing anytime after assessment, I would say. I think that the IRS is not necessarily always consistent with when a tax lien is filed, and the exact procedures that are followed are sometimes a little bit confusing as to when exactly the IRS can file a lien. So it's important to keep in mind that a notice of federal tax lien might be filed after an assessment. That should basically be given notice, giving a demand. You should have a demand for payment before getting a tax lien filed. But even if a notice is not received, the IRS can still file a lien. Notice of federal tax lien filing, if you look in your materials, it's basically, basically notification that a tax lien has been filed against a particular taxpayer. It lists the assessment date, the amount on the lien, and it just informs the taxpayer that a lien has been filed at the U.S. District Court in the district where they reside. If you look on this page where it says Internal Revenue Service Facsimile Federal Tax Lien Document, this basically gives you all the information about where the tax lien was filed. This one was filed at the U.S. District Court in Boston. Gives you the amount. Gives you the location where the notice was prepared and executed. So this is your notice of federal tax lien filing. Okay. So we're going to talk a little bit now about making your initial contact with ACS, Automated Collection Service. First thing you have to do before ACS will talk to you, or anyone in the IRS is going to talk to you about a client's case, is to file a form 2848, Power of Attorney, with a central authorization filing unit. And the IRS is not going to discuss the case otherwise, and you should allow at least 10 days for processing. If filed a power of attorney and it's been a few days, if it's not on file, they haven't processed it yet, they won't discuss the case with you. And one thing we do as a matter of course in our office is to request an immediate hold on collections activity. And this is typically granted if you're new to a case and you're just starting getting up to speed on a particular case. The IRS should grant a 30 to 45 day hold on collections. And these holds, as Morris wanted to discuss a little bit, they can be renewed depending on facts and circumstances of the case.
Yeah, I'd like to break in at this point. First of all, my apologies to some of you who are more experienced, and some of the information that Matthew has provided may be a bit basic, but this way we're all on the same page. As Matthew pointed out, when we have a notice of intention to assess, that is a very serious document. It is sent out, typically if we were dealing with ACS, it's sent out by the computer. It gives you, as the practitioner, 30 days with which to file a collection due process appeal.
Notice of intent to levy.
This is notice of intent to levy. And and the notice of intent to levy gives you 30 days to file an appeal. And at the same time, Matthew pointed out, you can easily obtain a 30-day hold on collection. And you can probably get some subsequent holds. However, if you choose to get a hold on collection and things don't work out, you've lost your right to a collection due process appeal as such. We're going to be talking about appeals down the road, and so I don't want to get into it right now. But the point that I want to caution you, it's one of the things that you should take away with you, is that if you file a collection appeal, this will still give you the opportunity, if you wish, to continue to deal with ACS, or if the case has already been assigned to a collection, to a revenue officer, you can continue to deal with the revenue officer. If you're able to reach an agreement, then you can always withdraw the appeal. If you do not reach an agreement, then you do have the appeal rights. And so what it does is it gives you an opportunity basically for dual negotiation. This may seem a little bit underhanded perhaps. Believe me, it is not. If you take a look at the publication 1660, which is not included in your materials, but just write it down, publication 1660, you can easily obtain it off of the website. You take a look on page 2, column 1, page 2 on the right-hand column, and you will see just that procedure suggested. So what we are considering doing in our practice is that, especially in situations where the dollars are there, to request the collection due process appeal right up front, so that in case things don't work out with the revenue officers, we have an avenue for an appeal and things don't get out of hand.
Okay, thank you, Morris.
You're welcome.
Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about options available to a taxpayer in different scenarios. If the taxpayer, you know, what to do with the taxpayer agrees, what are we going to do if the taxpayer disagrees with the assessment? So if the taxpayer does not agree with a particular assessment, what are his or her options? One option available to the taxpayer is a request for reconsideration. And this is something that Morris is going to address at the end of this panel in a few minutes. The other option is to file a Form 656L, which Attorney Groshek is going to discuss on our second panel, which is an offer and compromise relating to doubt as to liability. So we will get into that. We will get into that a little bit later. If the taxpayer agrees with the assessment, what are his or her options? Well, he or she can just pay the tax, make a lump sum payment of whatever tax is due, and that'll pretty much be the end of the collections activity right there. Another possibility is an informal installment agreement. Informal installment agreements are basically payments within a 3-month period. And the reason why they're informal is typically there doesn't really need to be anything in writing necessarily. It's just basically an agreement between the taxpayer and the IRS that the liability will be paid off within 3 months. And you know, holds on collections should be, you know, preserved at that time if there is an agreement to pay within 3 months. A formal installment agreement is payment over a period longer than 6 months. And those do need to be typically in writing, or just financial information needs to be provided over the phone. Yes?
Do they give you, when you say, greater than 6 months, what's the longest term usually?
Longest term, after six, it's 10 years, which is the statute of limitations on collections. Yeah.
If I can just interject, typically, and we'll be getting into this later on, typically they're looking for a payment within 5 years.
Right. And 3 years is like their optimal. They're looking for 3 years. 5 years is okay. 10 years is a stretch, but we were successful recently in getting a 10-year installment agreement, which is actually less than the full liability, which was interesting. We'll talk about installment agreements on the second panel. And another option is a offer and compromise. And this is a Form 656. And Form 656 will address two issues, doubt as to collectability and effective tax administration. Doubt as to collectability means that the taxpayer is not contesting the liability, but doesn't have the means to pay the liability at this time, the assets or the income to pay it. Effective tax administration basically means that if the IRS collects a tax, it's going to cause a hardship to the taxpayer. And the hardship is not in the best interests of the United States or the U.S. government. Another option is not currently collectible, which means that the taxpayer has no income or assets that can be seized at all. And the outline for how to pursue not currently collectible and the circumstances in which you can pursue not currently collectible status is in the Internal Revenue Manual. We didn't copy this as part of the materials. It was pretty lengthy, but it's the site is right here, IRM 5.16.1.1. Okay. Yes?
How long can you stay in that CMC, I know they call it status? How many years can you
not currently collectible?
Well,
as long as it's not currently collectible, from my experience, once a person gets in that status, they can stay in there for years. Basically, what will happen is the IRS computer will monitor the taxpayer situation, and they will, and every year, they will expect the taxpayer to file a tax return, and they'll take a look and see what the income is that is reported. And if the income begins to creep up, the taxpayer will get a notice saying, we would like to revisit the situation with you. However, even if the taxpayer's economic situation does not change, once a year, the IRS is required to send that taxpayer a notice. By the way, you still owe us $75,000 plus interest, and the failure to pay penalty continues to accrue. This is to encourage some people in this status not to think that they no longer have a liability. They have the liability, they just can't pay it at this time.
If it goes for 10 years, does that automatically?
Yes.
Relate?
Yes. It's done. Yes. Generally speaking, there's a 10-year statute of limitations on collections. There are some exceptions, which I've never run into in my practice, so I'm not going to discuss them. But the not currently collectible status does not toll the statute of limitations on collections.
So if you were on CNC for 10 years, you don't you're not done?
It's just the opposite. After the 10 years, you're done because the statute of limitations on collections continues to run. It is not told, it continues to run while you're in that not collectible status.
It's the same for an installment agreement. It doesn't toll the statute.
An offer works the same way.
No, an offer tolls the statute.
Okay.
There's a difference.
Okay. So another thing we're going to talk about is the form 433F, and a lot of you, I'm sure, are familiar with this form. It's called the Collection Information Statement, and it's basically the first chance for the taxpayer to provide his or her financial information to the IRS, other than a tax return. It's a list of income, assets. Basically, the IRS is looking for anything that can be either levied upon or perhaps sold or borrowed against to pay the liability. And we're going to get into Form 433F in detail in the second panel, which is coming right up. Some takeaway messages about the automated collection service. Automated collection service can approve installment agreements. So after providing the Form 433F information, you can work directly with the ACS to work out an installment agreement. I would say that the level of discretion with a with a automated collection service representative is not very high. So if you have a difficult financial situation, complicated financial situation, it might not be the best idea to work with ACS in trying to negotiate an installment agreement. You might want to work directly with a revenue officer, or even with appeals at that point. ACS can renew holds on collections, as Morris has explained, and so you can get a 30 to 45 day hold, but you can also extend those holds just by being vigilant, being sure to calendar all those items in your calendar, docket all those items. Make sure that you're calling ACS on a regular basis to extend the holds on collections. Another important thing is it's possible that when you're working with the Taxpayer Advocate Service, and Mr. Krupe will talk about this, that the Taxpayer Advocate can negotiate holds on your behalf. But that is not something you should assume is being done. If you're working with a Taxpayer Advocate on a particular issue, do not assume that he or she is going to work with ACS to extend holds on collections. That's a possibility, but you have to be very explicit about what you're looking for. If you want Taxpayer Advocates to negotiate holds on your client's behalf, just be explicit. Ask him or her to do so. Sure.
I'm not quite sure. We have a client, if you say not currently collectible, do you have to go to appeals, or do you talk to ACS, or do you file a form? What do you do?
It can be done anyway, but in order to get any kind of a resolution, it's necessary to file a financial form with the government listing assets, liabilities, income, and expense. If you're dealing with ACS, it's a 433F. If we're dealing with the revenue officers, usually it's a 433A for an individual and a 433B for a business. The 433F is a simpler form. It requires less information. But we're going to discuss all this in detail later. So I'll ask if we can terminate the discussion at this point. But we will pick it up later, Millie, and you'll get a full answer.
Okay. And at this point now, we're going to turn it over to Attorney Robinson, who's going to discuss request for reconsideration.
Thank you very much, Matthew. Perhaps it happens more to with us than perhaps with most people. We are a tax boutique, which means that we get the difficult situations that other people find difficult to deal with. And we've had several instances where people will come to us and say the IRS has sent us a notice of intention to levy, or they've perhaps even started a levy procedure, and they say, we don't owe the money. And I'd like to just go over very briefly what is involved here, because it is possible, even at this late date, to find redress. And this is done through a request for reconsideration. Before talking about it, and I'm going to try to be very, very brief because we're running a little bit behind, we have to keep in mind a couple of points. Point number one, there is bureaucratic reluctance to change things. The Book of Esther, 2,500 years ago, the Persian Empire. That which has been sealed with the signet of the king cannot be rescinded. Coupled to that, and with respect to the IRS personnel who are present in the room, there is a lack of experienced auditors. We have people who have, some people have 30 years experience. They were hired around the time of the 1981 recession. There are people with 20 years experience. They were hired at the recession that came along about 10 years ago. And there are a bunch of people who have maybe 3 years experience. And there's not that much in between, which means that that sometimes audits go off the tracks, especially when the people representing the taxpayers are themselves inexperienced. Inexperienced taxpayer representatives who may not be CPAs, they may not be licensed, they may be bookkeepers, and they may be
dealing with issues involving millions of dollars, inexperienced auditors, supervisors who are highly experienced but who are stretched to the max. It's a recipe for trouble. And I'd like to just suggest two experiences in our office that provide two diametrically opposite responses when we put in requests for reconsideration. In the one case, this came out of the Stoneham office. The IRS gave us the additional time that we needed to file amended tax returns. The auditors and the revenue officers were all very patient with us. The IRS accepted our returns as filed. There were some ambiguities. We spelled them out in a special form, 8275. It's a disclosure form, since we didn't know all of the answers, and we made our best guesses. Our best guesses were accepted by IRS. And the IRS even abated the 20% underreporting penalty for us. So it was a success. Case number two from the Southborough office. The agent's report was hopelessly confused. ACS kept giving us the additional time that we needed to make sure that a CPA was hired, that amended returns were prepared. However, the IRS agent resisted making changes. The IRS agent had invested more time than the agent should have in dealing with this case the first time around. The agent's supervisor had to justify the man months, or person months, that had been spent by the agent. And so the supervisor was not very helpful. We dealt with the supervisor's supervisor in Providence, and the supervisor's supervisor knew the score, but had some political issues. Before we were done, we were dealing with the director of audit for the Northeast region of small business self-employed, which is for all the New England states and for New York. Ultimately, the matter was resolved, and I think that but not before we found out that the agent had tendered her resignation. So it goes both ways, and I get no satisfaction from this whatsoever, because the time that was involved in dealing with all of these things was just plain phenomenal. The client was very, very upset, and rightfully so. So when I say that all that's necessary is to file an amended return, well, yes, but it can't. But there are the realities, and so you've got the spectrum of success and a pharic victory. So with that, we would like to go on to our next panel, which is entitled Structuring the Deal. And is Norman here yet?
No.
Well, if Norman isn't here, we will do the best we can without him. But I'd like to invite Jeffrey Groshak to join us at the panel table.